We've been studying Each Moment is the Universe, Zen and the Way of Being Time by Katagiri. And, I wanted to thank Mary for giving me this opportunity and to Zach for being my Benji. So the thing that really hit me in the gut as I was reading, there have been a lot of things when I was preparing for this where I thought, I could talk about that, and there's so much to say about that. But the thing that really struck me, I think, really in my gut, and I'm just going to read it out loud, is, and he's talking about practice and sitting, and he says, a deep, disconsolate flavor is always present in human life. At the bottom of your life, there is something like moaning. You just make a noise. Oh. You cannot stop the suffering, but you can go beyond it and see human life in a different way. If you see the aspect of body and mind that is beyond your dualistic feeling, emotions, and ideas, you can realize freedom from suffering. And so for me, I think that is really the revelation, I guess, is the word I want to use, or what I've discovered in my own practice. So there's this, in my gut, and what to do, I guess, was my question, and has been my question about that. I remember one time Mary was out of town, and I was to open the Zendo on for evening Zazen. I forget which evenings it were. And we didn't have a lot of people coming in the evening, but we wanted to have the Zendo open. And so I came and I opened the Zendo and I sat down in the Doan spot, and which was on the other side of the room from where it is now. So and one other person came, and I rang the bell, and we sat. They were on the other side of the wall, and so we couldn't see each other. And I've been practicing for a couple of years at this time, I think. And I sat, and it had been a really long day at work, and I was really tired. I hadn't gotten a lot of sleep. I was kind of grumbling in my head about, why did I agree to do this? La, 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 la. And then as I sat there, I got this enormous stabbing pain in my back. And it's kind of slowly got worse and worse. And I'd had pain sitting before, but this was pretty strong. And this actually has a lot to do with what I just read, because in the past, what I would have done is try to make it better, try to make it go away, so that I could sit, you know, so that I could do Zazen properly. And then I thought to myself, well, nobody else is here, and the person on the other side of the wall can't see me. I could lay on my back and no one would know. I used to do that with drinking too, you know, no one would know. But I think because of the discipline of practice of sitting there day after day after day, something else happened. And I'm not sure that I can explain it with words, but I thought, well, okay, I could do that. I could also just investigate where this is, what is this pain? And I did that, and the pain didn't go away, but my relationship to it changed. And for me, that's where the freedom in practice has come for me. And so the other thing that Katagiri said in the chapter, I have a million sticky notes in here, a deep sense of human value is that all of the teachings are contained in any of the teachings in a way. So impermanence and suffering and time. He talks about right now is time. And this was another surprising thing to me. Right now is time. I think of right now as being static. You know, right now is a moment and it's done. But my understanding from what we're reading is that that is time, right now. This moment of the 6,400,099,980 moments, right now, right now is time, and I'm time, and being time. And that's the opportunity. That's my opportunity to practice. That's my opportunity to find freedom. Because there's nothing to hold on to. Which, frankly, really freaks me out sometimes. that there's nothing. I think a part of that moaning at the bottom of my life, that, oh, is that desire for control, that desire for safety, that desire for ease, I think is the word. And he says this is because we have a human consciousness. You know, I wrote a lot of notes for this. I tried not to make myself an outline and to follow through, because I'm really trying to have a different experience of reading and learning the teaching and sitting and being. So if I have some long pauses, that's part of it. But as I went back over and looked at things again, all the way through, I had noted, I had written Zazen. Zen. Zazen. And part of me thinks I really can't say anything more than that, in a sense, because that has been my practice. I mean, I was physically in Vallejo for many, many years practicing, and I came back for my Bodhisattva ceremony, which is really wonderful. But I've sewed my Rakusu from a distance. When I first set up my altar down here for the practice period, and I got out some incense that John Briggs had given me when I sewed my Rakusu. And for those of you who didn't know John, he was a lovely person who sat with us for a long time and passed away of cancer. But he had given me some incense from Aheiji. And so I took that incense out. And when I offered fragrance, there was that smell that has been a part of my practice for 20 some years, you know. I mean, it's a smell. It's like walking in a house and smelling apple pie or, you know, chocolate chip cookies or something. It's a part of Zazen. The other thing that really stood out to me in this reading, and I was really surprised that he used the term spiritual security. And I'm going to try and find a spot. So he says, accept that your life is produced by the full commitment of the cosmic universe to movement. Everything is moving dynamically. Your life constantly gives you a chance, a great opportunity to touch the truth. If you touch it, everything comes alive in a refreshing way. At that time, you can really do something more than what you have thought. This is spiritual security. And so that's a very different kind of way of thinking for me about the idea of security or safety or constancy or regularness. And it has to do with what I think I talked about earlier, is in any moment, whether it's pain in my back or a rude driver in my face or a challenging boss, which I had for a couple of years before I retired, making big demands, or my own critical voices arising often. In all those moments, that there's an opportunity. And I relate that kind of spaciousness that can arise as what I think he means by that spiritual security. And I have found that to be true in my own practice and in my walking around the world and being in the world on a day-to-day basis, that particularly in challenging moments, I have more moments than I used to, not to be tossed away by my own self-centered fear, my own view, my own idea about what is going on here, wherever he is, you know. But I, you know, I also, Mary asked me at some point, I had said something about pain being the thing that brought me to practice. And she said, do you think pain is what brought you to practice? And, you know, right off the top of my head, I said, yes. You know, Absolutely. I didn't walk in because I was, you know, dancing in the rain, having a great time in my life. But I don't think it was only that. You know, there were things I would, but I also think, and it's true for others that I've spoken to, and Katagiri, Dogen talks about it, and get it, Katagiri talks about it as well in here. And it's that that longing, you know, which I associate with the term, the concept of desire. It's that aching longing for connection and belonging to something larger than myself. I think I've had that since I was a very small kid. You know, we used to go to mass every day when I went to school, and I would pray and pray and pray, and they had the statues of the Blessed Virgin up there, you know, and you know, and there were all these mystical stories about the saints, and you know, people, you know, if I prayed hard enough, I thought I'd see a tear start to come out of the statue, you know. So I mean, I would get so worked up, actually, I would faint, and they'd have to carry me out to the nurse's office, you know. So apparently, I've always had some great longing for a deeper connection with I don't know what. So, but in this book that we're reading, this is the deep suffering called dukkha. That is a part of the deep suffering. And the other part that really struck me was the writing about silence. And I don't want to go in and talk about all the different ways that he categorized silence. I mean, he talked about emptiness, oneness, devotion, and generosity, which are all beautiful ways for me to think about silence. But what really struck me was he was talking about silence being something very active. Deep silence is something that is active. And the Japanese word for this silence is mokurai. Moku means silence, and maybe it's rei means thunder. So silent thunder, you know. And I have certainly had that experience sitting zazen, you know. There's a lot going on when I'm sitting down there. I remember a therapist I saw after a couple of sessions, she said, "You have a very active internal life, Kate." And I thought, well, doesn't everybody? I mean, I'm not sure, but I think so. And I think that's what I discover when I sit down on the cushion. I think what I was hoping for was bliss. Only. And what I discovered when I sat down was, you know, a lot of activity in my body, in my mind, in my spirit, which I judged myself for. You know, I'm mostly still and peaceful and calm and just, and of course, I mean, I was corrected in my thinking about that. You know, it's normal. It's But what's wonderful about studying during a practice period and looking at these ideas is that I look at them again and again and again. And as much as I want to be able to hold on to a fixed idea of what it all means, and concretize it and make it solid, I never can. But it's also freeing because I don't have to, I don't have to. I can experience that deep silence. And I can understand what it means to be in my seat and sit zazen differently. Each moment, each time I sit down at the mat, each time I get distracted. I loved it how we talked about patting those things on the head. He said, just pat them on the head and let them. I hadn't heard that one before. I've heard other ways of dealing with, like all of those thoughts and emotions and feelings and everything else that happens as we sit still on our mats. But I love that deep silence. And he even talks about painters and poets try to express silence using materials or words, but they cannot do it completely. So there's always this disconsolate flavor. Same for sitting, same for being in the studio. Although I must say, every now and then, I finished a painting and thought, that's what I wanted to say, not often, but every now and then. And then of course there's more. So you're back with that disconsolate feeling. How am I doing on time? Am I supposed to end at...
You can end any time. It's 10:43, I think, 44. So any time, and then so you'll have some time for questions.
Okay. Okay, so I did find a poem, and I think I will end with this poem. This is a poem by David White, and he's a poet who currently lives on Whidbey Island, actually, which is not too far from where we are. But he I think, grew up in London and had an Irish mother and a Welsh father. And if you have the opportunity to ever hear him read this, it's on the On Being website. He has this wonderful, rich brogue, which just makes it delicious to listen to, but I will do my best. And this is called Everything is Waiting for You. Your great mistake is to act the drama as if you were alone, as if life were a progressive and cunning crime with no witness to the tiny transgressions. To feel abandoned is to deny the intimacy of your surroundings. Surely, even you at times have felt the grand array, the swelling presence and the chorus crowding out your solo voice. You must note the way the soap dish enables you, or the window latch grants you freedom. Alertness is the hidden discipline of familiarity. The stairs are your mentor of things to come. The doors have always been there to frighten you and invite you. And the tiny speaker in the phone is your dream ladder to divinity. Put down the weight of your aloneness and ease into the conversation. The kettle is singing even as it pours you a drink. the cooking pots have left their arrogant aloofness and seen the good in you at last. All the birds and creatures of the world are unutterably themselves. Everything is waiting for you. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Steve?
Yes. I really enjoyed that talk, Kate.
Huh. Oh, there you are. I can't hear you yet.
Oh, I think I unmuted myself.
There you are. I got okay, it cool. Now. Okay.
Oh, I was just saying I really enjoyed your talk. And I'm having one of those days, or hopefully I can say I was having one of those days where I feel that kind of moan arising. What you've reminded me of is that it's not just one of those days. That does come from pretty deep sometimes. And I don't have a lot to add. It just really resonated with me. So I wanted to say really thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Kelly.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for that talk. That was wonderful. I kind of wanted to share, like, when you were talking about sitting with pain and what that meant to you, I just, all these lights went on in my head because I remember maybe two sesshins ago, after sitting for a couple of days, having a very similar experience where it was like, oh man, I'm really hurting right now. And I don't know what to do with it. And I had a similar reaction to you, which was, well, let's get acquainted with it. And I spent some time and it's exactly what you were saying. You described it so well, where it was like the pain didn't go away, but my relationship with it completely changed. And it sat with me, and it sat with me for a day or so. And I never did try and run away from it. And I think I realized in retrospect that as much as I intellectually say that I commit to the practice, like that was the day that my body committed to the practice. And it felt so profound to me. So it was really nice to hear you kind of give your description of that as well, because I was like, yes, I went through that. Yes. So not so much a question, but a yes, I completely agree with that. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, and I never want anybody to think, and I mean, that you have to sit there with unbearable pain. I mean, if it gets bad enough, I move, you know, but it is so interesting to not just have a knee-jerk reaction to it. You know, to have a choice about how I react to it, you know, and also that I can move a little bit. I don't have to just, I'm so black and white, you know, oh, I'm in pain. I can't do this anymore. See you later. You know, I don't have to do that either, which would have been my MO in the past. So. Zach?
Well, one more sitting with pain story. I've had some of those, and Maybe for me, it's more of a macho thing, like I'm going to get through this. But maybe it's actually kind of like what you described. And I, afterwards, I always, when the bell rings, I always think, oh, that wasn't so bad. Like it's all up here. And I think what I have found, and maybe it's similar to what you and Kelly are talking about, is that in a weird way, those are the best zazens, because when you sit and it just sort of breezes right by and everything's good, those are cool, but they're not as deep or meaningful as where you sort of come to peace with sitting there. And I mean, I've never had pain like a tendon was going to tear or something like that. But I, in the back of my mind, I know this is just me being uncomfortable. Just hang out there. The bell will ring at some point and you'll once again say, oh, that wasn't so bad. So thanks for reminding me of that lesson.
Lisa?
Just to add with all the pain, I also, you know, when you were talking about it, I thought also about how that's where actually you notice how weird time is. Mm. Because, you know, when you're in that situation of pain, it just seems like, oh my God, this is 5 minutes is going on forever.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, you just, that's where I really can see that time is not what we think it is. And I also wanted to say that I identify with everything that you said in your talk. And especially, I also felt when I read the thing about the moaning at the depth of life, that struck me because, you know, recently during the pandemic, my neighbor and I, we go for walks, and we both kind of like, when we start out the walk, we both go, oh, you know, and we start to say the sort of all of these, you know, oh, my job and my boss and the government and the news and the and all of these things that we're dealing, all of us are dealing with now. But there's also, what struck me when I read it is there's also something, as Steve was saying, there's some other deeper moan. Yeah. That's that dukkha. But I really identified with your talk and the way you expressed it.
Jody?
Kate, thank you. That was really insightful. And I could relate to a great deal of what you talked about. I was also struck by the word spiritual security in the reading. It kind of stopped me for a minute and then I just moved on. But I appreciate your interpretation of that. I do think there's a great deal of security, for lack of a better word, in realizing that, you know, those moments are really quiet. I don't have to, what you call, concretize that moment, that I could just keep flowing and just trust that those moments will come again. I also wanted to reassure you that you're not the only one with a very active internal world life. I have a very busy mind and always kind of on. And today was a great example of that for me. And in my zazen, the first half hour flew by and I realized because I was busily thinking about the suffering that my family members are going through right now, and what I can do, and then at the same time saying, okay, just breathe, inhale and exhale, and then back to the thought, and then having a dialogue about, well, I have to think about life. I have to spend some time wondering about things that people are going through and what I'm going to do about it. And then it was like, okay, inhale, exhale. I had a very interesting experience in the last 15 minutes where time just like, I felt like it was 10 minutes, it was taking forever. And I did stop at one point. I had to look at the clock. I wanted to know how much time went by. And so I know a half hour went by. And then the next 10 minutes just slowly went by. But just recognizing in that silence that, you know, I was also thinking about how to be useful. That was a conversation we had on Wednesday. And sometimes just being quiet and sitting and not acting and not inserting myself into situations where people are suffering is useful. You know, suffering in my awareness of that eventually, which came, suffering brought me in the rooms, brought me to meditation, it brought me to sobriety, it brought me to so many times where I was at a place of surrender. And usefulness to me, I'm starting to recognize that is to let other people have their suffering and that may lead them to a place of change. And in some strange way, that offers me some security because I don't have to do or act or be something that somebody's needing me to be or that I think they need me to be. I could just be. I find some ground, I guess, in that groundless action, if that makes any sense. So thank you for your share. That was very valuable. Thank you.
Now that letting go is a big one for me, of thinking I can make things better, which, I mean, we can. I think we can help each other, but I've been known to stick my hand in too much and too often. So, is there anything else before we, I think it's about time.
I have something.
Mary.
Listening to you guys and listening to you, Kate, it suddenly dawned on me, in a deeper way, you know, when we do the Sajiki ceremony and we are calling the hungry ghosts to invite them. And what are we but hungry ghosts? Anyway, but when we call, we moan, right? It's like, oh, like, you know, stop it. It's a moan, and that maybe. Do
you think that's the moan he's talking about? I do. I was just thinking, no wonder. I mean, I love that ceremony and I love that moan. And I mean, it's like, okay.
Yeah, I think we understood it. We've always understood it sort of intuitively, but you, you know, you pointed at it in a way that deepens our understanding of it, or at least mine.
Well, it's for me, it's, you know, I grew up with a concept of original sin, right? I mean, I walked around when I was 5 years old envisioning this little black soul because of all the sins. Every time you sinned, you got a black mark on your soul, you know? And I mean, I look at five-year-olds now and I think, oh my heavens. But so this is the, it's like, oh, and it's not my fault. It's not my sin. It's our sin. And I don't think sin is necessarily a bad word. It's just the nature of being is this, oh, you know. I guess. Okay. Well, chant.